Right now, I'm very happy to welcome back to our program Richard D. Wolf, Professor of Economics Emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, who's currently a visiting professor in the graduate program in International Affairs at the New School University in New York City. Professor Wolf is host of the weekly radio show Economic Update, broadcast on WBAI in New York City, our sister station, and of course right here on WPKN on Fridays at 7:30 p.m. Professor Wolf's latest book is titled Capitalism's Crisis Deepens, Essays on the Global Economic Meltdown, 2010 to 2014. Professor Wolf is the founder of the group Democracy at Work that advocates for alternative solutions to the current model of our capitalism. Professor Wolf, it's great to have you back on the show. Thank you so much for making the time for us.
My pleasure, Scott. Glad to be here.
So I'm really looking forward to this topic, as it's something the country has been talking about for quite a while, and that is Bernie Sanders' campaign for the presidency, his quest for the Democratic Party nomination, and his discussion that he's been engaged in of democratic socialism and the need for a peaceful political revolution, as he puts it. I wondered, as we begin, Professor Wolf, if you would provide our listeners with an overview of what you take it to mean when Bernie Sanders talk about his long adherence to a political or economic ideology of democratic socialism.
Well, I think that Bernie Sanders is in a long line of people who believe in a particular kind of socialism and a particular kind of way of achieving it. For 50 years in this country, the last 50 years, it has been nigh unto impossible to discuss things like socialism, its different varieties, communism, because of the Cold War and the legacy of the Cold War. It became virtually impossible here in the United States to talk about it. Anyone who suggested that there was anything interesting or useful or valuable in the experience of socialism was considered somehow to be beyond the pale, disloyal, scary, all of the rest. Folks who were concerned about their careers quickly learned to stay clear of all of that in order not to compromise their opportunities for jobs, for rising in the job, and so on. And so we're kind of catching up here in the United States. Not the least contribution Bernie Sanders has already made is by allowing it to be back on the agenda. Just a footnote so people understand it. In every single European country, and indeed in most of the countries of the world, socialist political parties, some advocating democratic socialism a la Bernie, others having different ideas, have been part of the political landscape for decades. And it hasn't embroiled those countries in catastrophe. It has often led to governments in which socialists play an important role. For example, the entire government of France today, the president, the Senate, and their National Assembly, the majority in all of those is held by the Socialist Party. And nor is France in any way unique about this. So we're kind of playing catch-up here. So let me explain, then, what it means. Socialists are united basically in the idea that the human community can do better than capitalism. In other words, just as other economic systems, slavery, feudalism, and so on, have been born, evolved over time, and then died away, capitalism is most likely going to be like them. That is, it was born, it evolves, and then it passes away as human beings come to the conclusion that they can do better. So they got rid of slavery in favor of something else, got rid of feudalism in favor of capitalism, and the socialists argue the time has come, more or less, to go beyond capitalism. Some of them think that the way you should do it and the way you can do it is by peaceful political campaigns, winning votes, getting elected. That's what Bernie Sanders thinks. Other socialists doubt very much that the capitalist system will allow peacefully for itself to be pushed aside. They presume that capitalists have and probably will fight real hard and not always in a clean way to prevent the very process of history moving beyond them. And for them, for those socialists, they think something revolutionary is what's going to be needed, that evolution or political peaceful mechanisms, preferable though they might be, won't be enough to do the job. Bernie is very clear that he's not among that latter group, that he wants to do it peacefully, politically, winning people's hearts and minds to the notion we can do better. As to what exactly it means, what he wants, again, Bernie is quite traditional in the spirit of many socialist parties in Europe and other parts of the world. He has basically two ideas about what this democratic socialism should look like. First, the government should play a much larger role in making the economy work. The critique of capitalism of socialists like Bernie is that it favors the rich, it favors a minority, and that has to be corrected. That has to be offset by the active intervention of the government so that extremes of wealth and poverty are not allowed to develop, that unfair advantages to small groups of people are prevented or offset or corrected, and that the government should do everything from producing certain things to ensuring our health and welfare. Hence, he comes up with notions of a national health insurance, the notion that he's pushing of free tuition for college students. These are ways to do for average people, through government action, things that otherwise wouldn't get done in a capitalist system. And the second idea is that the market is not the best institution to use to distribute things. And there the socialist idea, again, is quite old, at least 150 years that I know of, and it goes something like this. What markets do is distribute scarce goods to the highest bidder. Literally, the old image is this. If there's not enough, let's take a concrete example. If there aren't enough seats in the baseball arena for all the people who want to go and watch the Yankees or the Mets or whoever else is playing, then the way the market works is it auctions off the scarce seats and the price of them is raised until those who can't afford it anymore no longer bid for it because they can't pay those prices. And what's left to go to the ball game are the people who have the money to buy it. Everybody might like to have a Mercedes, but most Americans can't afford a Mercedes. So the scarce Mercedes, only a certain number are built, basically flow into the hands of those with the most money. The socialist critique has always been the same. We shouldn't distribute goods according to the amount of money you have. That could be one of the things that determines where you distribute goods and services, but it shouldn't be the only one. We shouldn't distribute just to the people who got money, especially in our system where we don't ask where the money came from, whether you worked for it, whether you inherited it, whether you stole it. As long as you have it, you get the stuff. This is considered by socialists to be fundamentally unfair, and so they want the government to step in with planned distributions that distribute goods more according to people's needs, more according to what the society thinks is valuable. So in summary, the idea of socialism is the government has to step in to make the economy fairer, less unstable, more equitable, particularly to middle and lower income people, and to do that by rules, regulations, and planning systematically. And what Bernie is saying is this kind of socialism that has been an important part of the lives of people in most other countries can now finally, since the Cold War is over, can now become, as it should always have been, part of the political landscape in the United States. And he kind of represents a kindly, elderly senator from Vermont, showing that he can be a persuasive advocate for this being considered a part of American politics.
Thank you for that excellent summary, Professor Wolf. And I wanted to go on by asking you, in your travels around the country, as you speak to audiences about economics and socialism and capitalism and our current economic crisis, I know you you address a lot of different kinds of audiences. I'm wondering, as you look at Bernie Sanders' campaign for the presidency and his discussion of socialism, his discussion of democratic socialism, as he frames it, do you see his candidacy as an opportunity for public education, debate, and a better understanding of our current capitalist economy and the alternatives? Or do you think this could backfire in some ways, where you have surrogates for Hillary Clinton, as she also competes with Bernie Sanders for the nomination, surrogates like Claire McCaskill, who are on television saying, "No one will tell you this, but Bernie Sanders is a socialist." the kind of hearkening back to the Red Scare rhetoric. But on the whole, do you think Bernie's candidacy and discussion of democratic socialism is a net positive or negative?
Oh, it's crystal clear to me that it's an enormous net positive. This is not a question of endorsing him. I haven't endorsed anybody. I'm not going to. But it is no doubt, in my mind, an enormous step forward. You know, it was kind of childish for 50 years to be unable to have an intelligent conversation in American politics about the pros and cons of capitalism and to compare it to the pros and cons of socialism. You know, we take pride in the United States, and for good reason, that we debate the various systems that make up our society. We debate whether our schools are good or bad, can they be improved, whether our energy system, our medical insurance system. My goodness, here in the United States, we've been debating recently what marriage is and whether the definition and the institution of marriage should be expanded to include same-sex marriage and so on. The one system that we have been afraid as a nation to debate, to look at its goodnesses and its badnesses, its strengths and its weaknesses, has been our capitalist system. Every politician thought it was his or her job to outdo every other one in being a cheerleader. This isn't healthy. A healthy society knows that all of its institutions could be criticized, have flaws, and indeed that by identifying the flaws, you can go and make the society work better. And the flip side of that is if you don't debate capitalism and compare it to others, then you don't identify its flaws, and then you don't make it better. People today understand that our economic system is not working for a huge portion of our people. In my judgment as a professional economist, for example, the crash in 2008 has led to a recovery only for the top 5 or 10% of our people. The vast majority have been in a economic recession or depression now for 7 or 8 years. That is a terrible price to pay. And by the way, this is the second big collapse of our capitalist system in 75 years. We had the Great Depression in the 1930s. And then we had 11 economic downturns, count them, 11, between the end of the Great Depression, 1941, and the beginning of the one we're in now in 2008. Well, it doesn't take a genius to understand a system that crashes twice in 75 years and has 11 economic downturns when millions lost their jobs in between is a system that, at the very least, demands, needs, criticism, needs improvement, needs fixing. And so not doing that, all in the name of national security, has only meant that we have an economic system that wasn't fixed and isn't working real well, to say the least. And I think what Bernie is doing is saying, hey, it's much healthier if somebody, and I'm going to do it, brings up that socialism is an alternative, socialism has something to say, socialism has something to offer. Not that you have to agree with him, that's not the point. The point is, it's long past due in this country to have some honest debates about the pros and cons of economic systems so that we can and will do better in the future than we have been doing with an economic system like the one we're in. Let me make one additional point. As I travel around the country, what I'm seeing is not so much, at least not yet, not so much of an interest in socialism, although I think that's coming. What I am seeing is a serious disaffection from capitalism. When you see young people, as I have seen many, moving in the direction of saying they don't like capitalism real much, they prefer socialism, when I talk to them in detail, what's strong in their mind is a sense that the capitalist system we have isn't working. So they're taking a critical position. They don't know much about socialism, partly because over the last 50 years, very few of their teachers have dared explain it to them. Very few of their friends and relatives, if they were sympathetic, let on that they were. So there's a kind of a vast catching up about socialism, and Bernie is going to be, not the least of his contributions, is going to be that he fuels, he legitimizes young people particularly who are disaffected from capitalism, want an alternative, are now going to be told there is one, it's called socialism, and why don't you take a look at it to see whether there's something there you find interesting, persuasive, or valuable. Not because you have to, but because that's a healthy way to look at the economic system rather than pretending it's the greatest thing since sliced bread and perfection itself, which really is fundamentally silly.
We're speaking here on Counterpoint this evening with Richard D. Wolfe, professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, currently a visiting professor in the graduate program in international affairs at New School University in New York City. We're talking about Bernie Sanders' call for consideration of an ideology and economic discipline that he favors, democratic socialism, in his current presidential campaign. Professor Wolf, Bernie Sanders often refers to Scandinavian nations as examples of living, breathing democratic socialism, Sweden, Denmark, Finland, and Norway. But I read an interesting letter recently from the widely respected historian Eric Foner, who suggested that Bernie reach back to America's own radical tradition, especially the progressive populist era in the late 1800s, and the programs and ideology of Franklin Delano Roosevelt after the Great Depression. And he specifically pointed to programs never implemented, like the Second Bill of Rights that FDR proposed in 1944. I'd like your comment on that. What do you think of Eric Foner's suggestion here for Bernie Sanders?
Well, I agree and I disagree. I sort of a little bit of each. Let me explain. The basic point Eric makes is of course, reasonable. There is no need to go outside the United States. It's not as though we never had socialist movements, socialist politicians, and socialist governmental officials in the United States. Eric, being a historian, knows all about that, as any reasonable American historian might. I sometimes challenge my students by asking them, since I know they won't know the answer, what was the state in the United States that elected the most socialists into its state legislature so that the socialists really had a strong position in that state's legislature in the 20th century? The answer is Oklahoma. And when you say that, when you explain that to people, their eyes go wide because nowadays Oklahoma would be ranked among the more conservative parts of the United States. The point is that socialists have been at various times very important politicians. Since you're based in Bridgeport, you had a mayor in Bridgeport for quite some years who was a socialist. Jasper McLevy, if I remember his name.
Exactly, exactly.
Yes. Yeah. And so there's many parts of the United States where that was true, particularly in the Midwest and parts of the West and the East. So Foner is right that socialist examples of socialist programs, institutions, politicians, parties, all of that is available in American history in various times and places, including parts of the country you might be surprised at. But part of me disagrees because I think we in America have a long history of imagining that the world is all like us, that nobody else has anything but to learn from us, that we're not in a position to learn from others. Not only do I think that's incorrect and inaccurate, but there's something unpleasant about that, even obnoxious. I mean, we can learn plenty. Other people in other parts of the world grapple with economic problems very similar to our own, and we would be wise to see how they've solved those problems and to see what we can learn from them. And I think it's perfectly reasonable for Bernie Sanders or anyone else to point to ways of coping with economic problems discovered in countries that are committed to democratic socialism, how they've done, and to examine them. Again, not because they have the answer to everything, but because it's a good human openness to learn from what others have figured out. We don't have a monopoly on wisdom or ingenuity or effectiveness in our country. We have nothing to be ashamed of in the efforts we've made, but there's nothing wrong with learning from the others. So for me, I would rather say draw examples of where democratic socialism has worked well in the United States and elsewhere and see whether they apply today and to our circumstances and with what adjustments. That's how you learn. That's how you grow. And an honest society that isn't afraid of difference will do that.
We're speaking with Professor Richard Wolff, Professor of Economics at the New School University. And Professor Wolff, I wanted to ask you about the attitude of the younger generation towards the economic systems of capitalism and socialism in the world today. I have noted, as I know you and many others have, there are many young people attracted to Bernie Sanders' critique of today's capitalism and coming on board his campaign in large numbers, his campaign for president. And I think that's probably owing to the fact that the younger generation, some in the millennial generation as well, have not been exposed or have not suffered the indoctrination of the Cold War years where the S word or the C word, the references to communism, were just, was almost tantamount to cussing in public. I wonder if you would assess for us the chances that you might see a movement develop that would question more forcefully our current economic system and the diminishing horizons for young people in this country, that we might see many people more specifically articulate criticisms of capitalism in future years.
Yeah, there's no question. In my travels around the country, and I do a great deal of speaking around the country these days, I just got back from the West Coast, from the states of Washington and California. It is very clear that some of the kinds of enthusiasm of young people that we saw in 2008 gathering around the campaign in that year of Barack Obama, something like that is happening now. Then I think partly it was a young man, an African American, something that an awful lot of Americans had thought they'd never see, or at least not in their lifetimes, having a serious campaign for president and being an attractive spokesperson and so forth. You're seeing that now gathering around Bernie Sanders. And I think people are going to discover that just as Barack's candidacy surprised with its strength and its momentum, that pretty much the same thing is now happening around Bernie Sanders. At the same time, there are some crucial differences. Even in these 8 years since Barack Obama did that back in 2007 and 2008. And here are the differences I think are crucial. One, you've pointed to. The Cold War is always receding. It's getting further and further back in history. And so more and more young people are precisely people who have not grown up being trained, as, for example, I was in elementary school, to climb under my desk when there were nuclear war drills, where it was explained to us that some evil people, we didn't even understand what it meant, called Russians in my school, were out to kill us all in some horrific way. You know, if you're 8 years old and hear this story and then you hear it over and over again, by the time you're a thinking adult, that stuff is deeply in your brain and probably difficult to dislodge. We now have a growing part of our population, the young people, who had no such experiences, who didn't hear about a Cold War because it was over as they grew to maturity. So all of that prejudice and all of those endless campaigns of hysterical we're good, they're bad levels of analysis, those didn't affect these kids because they didn't go through it, the ones that are young now. At the same time, and also very different from Barack Obama, 8 years since him, we now have an entire new generation of young people finishing high school and being told that the job market that they face is much poorer than the one that faced their parents, that they better go out and get a college degree or else they'll never get a decent job, never earn a decent living. Because of the crisis and the crash in 2008, the very parents who explain that to their children don't have the money to pay for the kids to get the education they desperately need. So this new generation is going into heavy debt, $20,000, $40,000, $60,000, $100,000 to get a Bachelor of Arts degree at the end of 4 years of college, only to discover that that degree is no longer the ticket to a job, let alone a job with enough income even to allow you to pay off this student loan. And we have an enormous generation of the best and brightest young people coming out of our educational institutions with a sword hanging over their heads, with a debt that is enormous relative to the jobs and incomes they can earn. Those young people feel betrayed. They were told to study hard, to work hard, and the American dream would be there for the taking. And they've done all they were asked to do. But the American dream is out of reach. They can't do it. And those people are becoming critical of an economic system that denies them a chance to contribute what they've learned, denies them a chance to have the kind of life they expected and want, denies them even the chance to replicate the experience of their own parents. And they are not happy about it. And when you tell them that this is the greatest economic system in the world, they look at you and think, you're crazy. Or you're just talking about a very tiny group of folks at the top, and that they have been excluded, even though they did everything that was supposed to be done to get them to the good place their parents had told them about and promised them. I think it would be very naive not to understand that between the young people who can't get, you know, $9 and $10 an hour and the college graduates who are wavering under a mountain of debt facing a very mixed job opportunity picture, it'd be very naive not to understand that these are people who have, of course, got a powerful and indeed well-grounded critique of an economic system that is not working for them. When they then discover that one of the programs or demands of democratic socialists around the world is that higher education be a free service of the government, as it is, by the way, in most European countries, then Americans are going to be understandably upset and be very interested in a socialist alternative that could immediately transform a very urgent problem for them and for the coming generation of students as well.
Well, Richard, this has been great. I hope we can continue this conversation, and I hope to speak with Bernie Sanders himself on these airwaves on this same topic. But we'd love to have you back, and I certainly appreciate the very, I think, insightful description of the economic systems that we are dealing with, capitalism and democratic socialism, and the intersection with Bernie Sanders' campaign and his platform. So thank you so much, Professor Wolf. We will look forward to hearing more of your discussion of these and other issues on your program Economic Update that our listeners can hear on WPKN on Fridays at 7:30, or alternately on WBAI in New York City, 99.5 FM.
Thank you very much, Scott. I really appreciate your having a program where these kinds of things can be discussed at a reasonable and even-handed way. It'll be a pleasure to do it again whenever you're so inclined.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much, Professor
Wolf.
Take care. Good night. That's Richard D. Wolf, Professor of Economics Emeritus at the University of Mass, Massachusetts, who's currently a visiting professor in graduate program of the International Affairs Department at New School University.